Hello, everyone. It's Mike Ryan, executive producer of the Dan Le Batard Show with Stu Gatz and these South Beach Sessions. You're coming here for the Pat Sajak goods. We're going to give you the goods, dude. Pat Sajak is a tremendous friend of the show. It's a relationship that's randomly been fortified through the years. I mean, Pat Sajak's in that upper echelon tier of friends of the show with Bob Einstein and the late Alan Thicke. Wow, he's actually like the lone living one. Look, game show hosts, they've probably been at the front of your mind with the sad news of Alex Trebek's sad passing after a hard-fought battle with pancreatic cancer. We didn't dive too much into that because, look, this was born out of Dan just catching up with a friend and seeing how he was doing, as that was a very difficult loss for Pat and really for America. But that friendship is how this South Beach Sessions came together. After Dan checked up on his friend to see how he was doing, he agreed to do South Beach Sessions. Now, it's very exciting whenever Pat Sajak decides to allow us to get content from him. Believe me, there's a lot of no's there because he's a very busy man. So, without further delay, here is the incomparable Pat Sajak on South Beach Sessions with Dan. A lot of great stories here. We try to get Pat in trouble every time he joins us, which is, come to think of it, why he says no often. Maybe we achieve that, maybe we don't. Either way, it's a good episode. Enjoy.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the television industry, Pat, because I'm curious, and this is a wide net I'm casting here, but I'm curious about like some of the things that you've learned being in television, being in show business as long as you have. Like, you are spanning a long time, and the television industry, it's rare. The run you've had is uncommonly rare. Maybe Ed Asner has had one like it, but you know, other than that, there aren't a whole lot of people. I'm sorry, I just went for an Ed Asner joke there because the funny name that Pat Sajak enjoys. There aren't a lot of people who have had your run, and so what kind of learning have you done about yourself, about vanity, about mortality? This is broad, huh?
Wow, man. Oh, man. Do we, this is, I feel like I'm, is Buckley still alive? This is, it's a firing line question. First of all, the longevity is crazy. I mean, I can't even grasp it. I was thinking, we were talking the other day about people, fads, crazes, hot shows, hot genres that have come and long gone. And we're still there. I mean, if you go back to 1981, when I started, and look at what was on television, and look who were the hot singers, and then do a kind of a timeline through the ages, you find all these can't miss stars, all these number one shows that were number one for 6, 7, 8, 10 years. They've come, they've gone. There's another list of people. I mean, we're like an overlay over everything else. It's really strange to me. That's the most amazing part is, and I'll get more specifically to your question, but obviously not only television, but the world has changed dramatically over these 40 years. And somehow with us, with very little change, we've managed to sort of tag along for the ride. It's really kind of awe-inspiring in a way. As far as my business is concerned, there's been one constant that from the beginning when I started in television, when there were three networks and maybe one local station in every market, nobody knows nothing about anything. Nobody knows what makes a hit program. Nobody knows who's going to get hot. Nobody knows who's going to prevail. But everyone pretends they do. I can't tell you how many production meetings I went into where a television executive said, you know what people want to see? And you want to interrupt them and say, no, I don't. Nor do you. Because if you did, every show on your air would be a hit instead of the crap you're airing. The biggest hits have been accidents. You know, American Idol was played off in the summer because they knew the audience was low. And if it was a crappy show and it wasn't going to matter, well, what did they know? And shows that can't miss are go away in 3 weeks. So that's the common theme, which is nobody knows anything, and they know less now because technology is changing so much, and they're scared to death. But they all pretend they do, and they go from job to job and company to company, with this badge that says, I know what's going to happen, and I know how to make a hit, and I know how to make this company do such and such. And they're at the mercy of two kids in a garage who are going to invent something tomorrow. So they're all scared to death, and they're all, I don't want to say stupid, but they're no brighter than anybody else, but they think they are. They really believe it, and they manage to convince others that they are. So that's sort of my take on television.
So you've learned that television executives are, you know, unimpressive, or like,
well,
what?
There's some very, I've worked with some really nice ones over the years, and I've worked with some real idiots. But the one thing, the best ones are the ones who say, you know what, I don't know everything. We've been very lucky since Wheel's been on. We've had some really good people come through, studio executives, since we were, you know, no longer a mom and pop operation with Merv Griffin and King World when they sold out in the 80s. You know, we've been big corporation, and we've had liaisons, you know, representing the corporation on our show, who have basically said, most of them said, you know what, you guys have been doing this for decades. You know what you're doing. Call me if you need anything. We're here to support you. And that was it. And that takes a lot, because when someone stamps your job position on your forehead, you go in and you think it's like buying a baseball team. Suddenly you're an expert on baseball, and you may not be, you may be a fan, but you got to hire good baseball people. But a lot of executives go in thinking they have the answer because now they're an executive, and so they must, otherwise they wouldn't be in that job. The smart ones recognize what I just said earlier, which is, we don't know anything. And if you see something that's working, let it work. And if you see something that needs your support, support it, but stay out of the way as best you can. And that's a hard thing for anyone. Everyone has an ego. Everyone thinks they have something to offer. But the smart ones know that they don't have all the answers.
I find you, and have found you, to be a wise person, that you have life perspective, you have experiences that have shaped you in a way that you've just seen a great deal, which is not a fancy way of me saying that you're old. But I am curious, as a wise person, sorry, Freudian slip, also a white person.
I am. When you look up Caucasian in the dictionary, my picture is there.
As a wise person, do you sometimes get bored with the idea of, man, I've been spinning this wheel for a long time? Because you're a man who had, I've told you this before, we've talked about it, your talk show had some real potential, because you are excellent at the doing of television. And the breadth of your sense of humor is something that can be on Wheel of Fortune, and I see on Wheel of Fortune, and it tests your skills in Windows. But I am curious whether or not you go in any days and just aren't quite stimulated because you're doing the same thing. And I find you to be a creative person, so you're doing the same thing after so many years.
You know, there I would have answered this question differently 20 years ago, maybe, you know, it's even longer ago, when in the sort of talk show age, where that was getting a lot of my attention, and there, you know, there was a lot of disappointment that didn't work out. There may have been some of that. But I have to tell you, as the years have gone on, and in the last 10, 15, maybe even going back a little longer than that, certainly right up to today, it's oddly enough, and I know this will sound strange, because to your eye, yeah, I'm doing the same thing. But to me, that's the greatest challenge. What I said earlier about us prevailing against all these headwinds and all these changes, I'll pat myself on the back a little bit. It takes a special skill. I don't even know what it is, to do that. I mean, to go in for show number 7,000 and treat it as show number one, and make the people feel at home, and try to get the contestants feel at home, try to get something out of them, try to make them look good, try to make them comfortable, try to make the audience want to come back the next day. To me, that's the toughest job in show business. You know, if you're riding a hot horse and it's, you know, it's just running away with things, and it's going to run until it wears itself out, that's fine. And there have been a lot of examples of that. But we're riding across country on a wagon train, and it takes some doing, and it takes a special skill that I don't know what it is. I don't like to analyze it too much because I may lose it. But I don't have that. I don't have the here we go again problem. I really don't. We just did last Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We did 18 shows in essentially 65 hours. And at the end of them, you're tired, But I swear to you, the 18th show, I worked just as hard. I worried just as much about those three vulnerable people up there as I always do, and was pleased when they did well, and pleased when the show did well, pleased if I got a laugh. And in a way, that every year that goes by, I appreciate that more. I appreciate the challenge. I look forward to the challenge, and I recognize it as a challenge.
What would you say is the key to being likable on television? I have not learned it. I've been on television for 20 years. Honestly, because I do marvel, like the reason Pat Sajak is beloved is because people feel like they know you. It's not just the longevity of it. It's they feel that you are a pristine person whose image is right next to that wheel that has, an ancient purity about a faraway day in America where the three channels you're talking about, there's a wheel spinning and, you can't desecrate the wheel. It's almost like in the television landscape, it's basically a religious symbol.
You know, I don't know. I know a few things. First of all, when the show started, it doesn't seem that way because I've been doing it so long. It seems natural that I'm there, but I was sort of an unusual choice in that what I had done in television up to that point was essentially what I'm doing now, which is being myself, and I'm a pretty low key. I'm not a type A personality. I mean, one of the problems with the talk show is you didn't tune in for a week and say, my God, this is the greatest, most talented guy since sliced bread. Look at the dynamo there. It's the kind of thing you sort of begin to appreciate over time, because I think I wear well and I don't wear myself out easily. And maybe in the hyper competitive world of late night, that was not the best tack to take, but it's the only tack I know. It's the way I've always been. But when I started, the network was not happy with the idea that Merv chose me for a number of reasons. I was too young, and Dave Letterman had just failed in daytime on NBC, and they were going to hire me for this, what was then a daytime show on NBC. Plus, I didn't fit what was then the stereotypical game show host mold, which was, hey, you just won $10,000, that kind of thing, which I don't do. And so it didn't.
You did it pretty well right there. It feels like if I asked Pat Sajak right now to do the stereotypical pukey broadcaster voice guy, I feel like you could do that okay. I feel like you wouldn't be terrible at the effect.
I could do it, but it would wear me out and I'd shoot myself after three shows. So God bless Merv, no matter what you've read about him or what you've heard about him, he's a great guy. And he said to, when I raised this to him, I said, I have to do it the way I do it. The way I did the weather, or the way I did where he saw me and he liked me, the way I did local talk shows that he saw and he liked. He said, that's why I'm hiring. And he never once in the years he owned the show came to me and said, hey, why don't you rev it up a little bit or do something? My point is that I think that that's helped a little bit, that I'm not a type A guy. I'm sort of, I'm the guy who lives next door and he's a pleasant enough guy. If I need sugar, I'll go over and get it. And I think I've somehow stumbled into a balance between the following. I appreciate the show. I appreciate what it means to people's lives, not to make too much out of playing hangman for 30 minutes. But when you've been doing it for 40 years, it means something to people. It means it's an evocative show. I watched this with my grandmother and now I'm watching it with my kids, and it brings back memories and simpler times and all that kind of stuff. So I'm appreciative of that. I celebrate that. I try to treat it that way. On the other hand, I think there's a little bit of my demeanor on the show which where my head is a little bit cocked, saying, look at this, we're playing hangman and we're all getting rich. This makes no sense. And I think that part of it allows people who might not ordinarily sit in front of their set and watch someone spin a wheel and yell, come on, big money. I think that gives them an okay to do it, because hey, Pat's having a bit of a hoot here, and so am I. This is kind of fun, and we're not taking it too seriously. But I take the show very seriously, and again, as every year goes by, I appreciate more and more what this dippy little show means to people and their lives and their time clocks and their memories and their associations and the people they've lost. There aren't many things, television shows or anything, that span this amount of time, that connect people from so many different time areas.
I asked you the keys to being likable, and you basically said just be yourself, which is another way of saying be you. That I can't be myself. I've been trying that on television. You're saying be you. You are relentlessly yourself. You are not strident. Like, I can't even imagine. I have a hard time imagining you angry. I imagine America does too.
Yeah, and I do sometimes, and I'm angry about some things today that I won't get into. But it had nothing to do with you, by the way.
I was 10 minutes late for this. That's what it is, right? I kept you waiting. No. You're a diva. You're a Hollywood hotshot, and I kept you waiting for 10 minutes. You were filled with rage, and you berated my producer and threatened to urinate on it.
Do you know everything but the last part is true? Do you know that there have been times in my life and career where I have thought, you know, because I look, there are jerks in my business, and I know who they are, and most people in my business know who they are. If you got 50 people in the room now, cameramen, producers, writers, everyone, and said, right on the list, who are the five biggest jerks, on camera jerks in television?
Steve Harvey.
They would make a list, and four of them would match. Everybody knows who these people are. And I sometimes, but they don't seem to suffer any consequences for it. They're still beloved on the air. And sometimes I think, you know, I should have been a jerk. Life would have been easier. I probably would have gotten more than I wanted, and people still would have loved me. I don't know. I may need to rethink this be yourself stuff.
I don't know if the audience knows this, but Pat Sajak is somebody who was on one of the first highly questionables, and there was just a scandal involving him saying, yeah, one time him and Vanna went to get margaritas and did a couple of shows. And then those entertainment shows with the clanging noises and bells said, you know, drunk at the wheel, and turned it into a controversy. And we had to send him a bunch of margarita mix as a way of apology and stuff. And so I was just hoping at some point during this podcast that you could like name one of those people so we can make news and just have the headline, Sajak, colon, Steve Harvey or Ellen DeGeneres is a real asshole. And I'd like that headline. I don't know if you could talk around it or if you can hint anything, if there's anything we can do.
You've just done it. No. No, I'm kidding. But you know who they are too. Come on, Dan.
I don't.
We all know who they are. Television is forgiving in that way. I don't understand it. So, you know, it wasn't just be yourself, because there are a lot of people whose selves aren't very likable. But I don't have to, when I'm backstage, I don't have to screw on my game face, I guess. And that's why it's part of the reason that hasn't worn me down over these years. I mean, you do hit a performance level that's different from if you're just sitting around the house, but it's not extreme for me. So I don't have to come down from anything. I mean, when the show's over, I can go to a baseball game and be fine. I don't have to decompress anywhere. I don't have to take a couple of days off or have a couple of drinks or what. I'm fine. I go, you know, if I'm backstage getting ready to go on, I could be talking to someone or telling a joke, and I hear my name and I walk out, and I don't have to elevate myself too much. And I think that can wear you out. If you really are a totally different human being on air and off, I think it's not so much that the audience recognizes, I think to some degree they do, but it's easier on your body and on your psyche.
Because it's hard work, right? I think people might look at it and say, you've got the easiest job in television. And you would say what to that, even while you're very grateful. And frankly, in all the years we've talked to you, like, you saying that you have the skill of challenging yourself and, you know, finding your motivation every day, it's as close to you not being humble as I have heard. And you were very careful with it, because you understand that your humility is part of your charm as well. But it is difficult, correct? It's not the easiest job in television.
Yeah, I mean, Winston Churchill once described a fellow politician as a humble man with much to be humble for. And I sometimes feel that way, but I'm a professional, and I take great pride in what I do. And yes, I'm a skilled professional. And as if you say the job, anyone says the job look easy, I take that as the highest compliment. It's supposed to be. It's actually an incredibly difficult show to do. You are in the studio with three people who've never been inside a television studio at all. You have to work with each of them differently. You have to approach them each differently to try to get them through that, navigate through that hour. If they make a mistake, you can't laugh at them as cheap a joke that would be. you gotta handhold them. You gotta get them through that half hour so that they do their best. Because if you're cruel, you're gone. I mean, you do that two or three times, and the audience will say goodbye. And you can't be. It wouldn't occur to me, because they are so vulnerable. They're so excited to be there, and suddenly the reality of it hits them, and it is totally different from being in your living room. So there's that element. The game is ridiculously complicated. I mean, I know you're just spinning a wheel and calling letters, but every spin has 15 different possibilities of things that can happen within that, and what happens next, and what went before, and what did the buzzer mean, and what did the, and it's all kind of coming at you. And you get to a point, you do it enough that it becomes kind of second nature, but you can never let down your guard. I mean, the moment I start thinking about, oh, she said that, I got a funny line for, whoops, what happened? You know, where'd I forget? Where am I?
It's so moving that fast. It's moving that fast.
It is. I mean, again, it looks leisure. The wheel spins are not boom.
Uh-huh.
But it is, there is, it's coming at you unrelentingly for those 25 minutes, and multiply that by 6 times in a day and 3 days in a row and 18 shows over.
Why do they do it like that? Why do they do it?
Well, it's financial. I mean, almost every game show tapes multiple shows, because from a production standpoint, you save a lot of money. You bring a crew in for one day as opposed to 5 days, and that alone saves you a ton of money. So it's always traditionally a game, other than the very earliest days of television when everything was live, especially daytime shows that were on 5 times a week, they always did multiple shows. Dick Clark, I love Dick, but he was nuts. When he did Pyramid, he would do 10 shows. They had to bring an extra crew in because they couldn't keep up with him. But that's because he had other things to do. He wanted to go do American Bandstand or watch a wheel drop or something, or a ball drop. He had other stuff to do, other shows to produce. So he wanted to crank out as many as he could. But that's typical of game shows. And by the way, when I do interviews with local entertainment reporters or everything, and they're asking the usual questions, and then when it gets to my schedule and I start talking about it, you can just see the green rise up in their throats, of the envy of the fact that I work so few days. And by the way, that's part of it too. I work very hard when we work, but I swear, in dog years, I've only done the thing about 12 years.
You have a dark and jagged sense of humor. Are you comfortable with the fact that most of America probably doesn't know that and might even be surprised to learn it?
Yeah, I mean, no, it doesn't bother me. I know you don't sit in front of the set every night and yell, "Come on, big money." But if you watch over a period of time, you would. I managed to sneak in a thing or two. And it is funny, the number of people who come up to me and go, "I know what you're doing out there. I got what you did." And that's kind of fun. So it doesn't hurt anybody. And if someone gets an extra laugh out of it, that's fine. And if they don't, it doesn't hurt.
Is there anything you hate about the job?
No, I've hated, and hated is maybe even stronger. I've really disliked probably each season. There are two players that I would like to see walk off a plank. But for the most part, I'm fine with, here are the kind I don't like. And they happen very rarely now, is the kind who are there. It's kind of a hoot. They sort of dared their friends they'd get on, and they're going to play it a little bit, and they don't care about the game. They're going to show off and be funny and try to top me or whatever they're going to do, and try to be a performer. That happens every now and then, not much. So those, I don't much care for those people. The only thing, so players, it's funny when they come on, and I get a little exasperated, not when they'd make a mistake, because I understand how that happens. Believe, until you're out there, you can't understand how easy it is to do something stupid. But when they come out and, hey, I've been waiting to be on for 3 years, and this assumes they're not living on the street, that they actually have a home and family and they make a living. They come on the show, they've got, $1,200 in front of them, and they got a puzzle up there, which now they figured out, but there are about 15 unlighted letters and they want to solve it. I say, I want to say, why did you come here? I mean, why don't you, how often do you get a chance to just spin a wheel and make some money? So if you hit a bankrupt or don't come and take your house and car, what are you doing? So it's that sometimes they don't want to make a mistake, and they want to win something. I want to say, you got a chance to we have this thing on our, it's called the mystery wedge, and you can win $10,000 or it can be a bankrupt. Those are the two choices you have. And so if you have a lot of money, I can understand you not wanting to, but if you have a little money, how often do you get a chance to flip a coin? And if you heads, you get 10,000 and tails, you don't. I mean, and they don't do it. So that makes me a little crazy. Not they should be reckless gamblers, but right. You're there to win some money. Why take a chance?
Play the damn game mathematically correct. Let's go game right.
A little bit, yeah. But I mean,
respect the game, respect the brand.
But I swear to you, I don't even know why people want to come on the show. And I mean, in this day of social media, I mean, if you do say something really goofy, you know, these things, they're on YouTube and they're on Twitter for the rest of your lives. And all of you go back to work and people are just going to pummel you with it. Why did you say that? Well, you know, it happened. So I don't know that I would take the risk if I had the chance.
You consistently, I see clips and I'm amazed by it. Like something uproariously funny or weird happens where somebody has solved a puzzle and you can't believe it. Like in terms, if Pat Sajak were writing a book about the three or four most memorable things across four decades that have happened, where the stories he would tell about just ridiculousness that happened on the set of Wheel of Fortune, do you have any go-tos? Do you have?
Well, you know, the problem, I'll tell you one or two. The problem is they're not real funny in the telling. It's kind of, you had to be there. But we're in Hawaii, and it's a fun clip. You should look it up. We're in Hawaii once. And look up Sajak Brown Horse. That'll probably come up. So we're in Hawaii and we had teams playing. They were local people, really nice, you know, Hawaiians. And they were there having a good time in their flower shirts and things. And there was a puzzle that was very early. It was a long puzzle. It was very early on in the solving process. No way anyone could solve it. And somebody said, they spun and they said, we're going to solve. And it shocked the heck out of me. And they were wrong. I was totally wrong. The words kind of fit, but he said, riding a brown horse. And it wasn't even close to what it was, but it's, the words sort of fit in. And he took a chance. So the next people do it, and they call a letter. Again, a totally unsolvable puzzle. And she says, riding a black horse. That was her answer. Like, that's what they got wrong. And I don't know why that amazed me. And I just screamed at the top of my lungs,
no.
Who said anything about a horse? And I walked off the set into the ocean, which was behind us. Now, that's not a funny story, but if you look at the clip.
What do you mean it's not funny? It is funny. Of course it's funny. What do you mean it's not funny? It's not funny.
So we do have one problem on the show now. It's harder and harder to do puzzles that are fair to everyone generationally. For example, we have a puzzle about, you know, music or song title. What's a fair song title? If you've got someone who's 22, someone who's 42, and someone who's 62 on the panel, that 62-year-old doesn't know one song that the 22-year-old is listening to, chances are, and vice versa. There was a time before all these streaming services where you could pick exactly what you want to hear, where everybody knew a lot about when I was growing up listening to the Beatles and my parents were listening to big band music, I hated big band music, but I knew who they were. I knew who the people were. And my parents knew who the Beatles were. Nobody knows anything now. There's a wall.
I didn't know that fairness was important. Like, one of the many wise things that you've said around here is you don't have to learn anything anymore. You just have to know how to find it. And it's a difference between how young people learn and old people learn. But I had no idea that fairness was something that you guys even aspired to there.
You choose these puzzles, you want to get them solved, you know, you move on to the next puzzle at some point. But if you do a song title that's totally, or a rap singer or something that's totally foreign to one or two of your players, you're going to have a real long game. And the people at home, a lot of them, aren't going to know the puzzle, and then they get frustrated watching these people try to solve it. So we rarely do.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It's just there's a in terms of the popular culture, there's an absolute wall between generations that didn't used to exist. Even in terms of expressions of the day, everybody kind of knew everybody's expression. You know, all these things that we grew up, or my generation, and even the next one, maybe even yours. You know, these a stitch in time saves nine. Those are gone. I mean, yeah. They're not just, they're gone. They've disappeared from the lexicon. So it's very difficult to do that. And another area where we have trouble is people are generally less well-read. They read a lot of stuff, but it's not stuff that we all kind of grew up reading and know. So we rarely do book titles. We rarely do plays. We don't, you know, we have to stay away from a lot of movies. We have to stay. We, the popular culture is really tough for us. So about a year ago, to add one more funny story, we decided to take a chance. They showed me the puzzle. I said, "You sure you want to do this?" And I said, "And the puzzle was a streetcar named Desire, Tennessee Williams, you know, best known play and a movie and all that." Nobody knew it. It was clear as they were trying to solve it, and everything was up there except the M in named. And the guy said, "I'll solve it," kind of tentatively. And he said, "A streetcar, naked desire." That was it.
It's a good guess.
It was a good guess. In fact, I said to him, and then the next person did solve it. And as I said, when I went over, I said, "Frankly, I would rather see that movie than the one that was correct." But that's a problem we have. We have a problem in just things are changing. People's base of knowledge is changing. And again, the big problem is the generational problem. If you had all young people, we try to mix, you know, we want to appeal to everyone. So we don't have three septuagenarians on our show. We try to mix it in, but it does challenge us. The only songs we can do that every generation, most generations know, are holiday songs. You can do Christmas songs. Everybody knows Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, but otherwise, if it crosses a generational line, there's a wall there, and we can't cross it.
Is there anything about the show that you find that fans are surprised to learn? Something that you know that others don't know, or something that you appreciate that perhaps a viewer might not be discerning enough to appreciate? Because I think some people are going to be surprised to hear that it's hard, right? For example, so that is something. But do you have anything else like that?
No, I mean, I think again, if you're just a civilian watching our show, you have no idea the pressure that starts the moment the game begins in the studio. And virtually every player says when they go home and watch from now on, they're going to be more understanding of what these. I mean, people say what seem to be incredibly stupid things, or they're incredibly obvious things that they don't see. But boy, they're so much more obvious in your living room than they are in the studio. Just your perspective. Think about this. I mean, you've been watching all your life on a, you know, even if it's a big plasma, or do they make plasma anymore? I'm sorry. Some, you know, the big smart TVs that they have. But even so, you're in a studio, and you know, 25 feet from you is this giant puzzle board with these enormous letters and a woman but walking back and forth. Even that perspective changes your view of the game, you know. So I think the difficulty all around, now we talk about the difficulty of hosting, but certainly the difficulty of playing the game, you don't appreciate till you're in the studio.
Can you give me a number, a numerical answer to this? It might be zero. Seven. Number of arguments you've had with Vanna.
One. And I have an ongoing thing with Vanna. This is actually, there's some truth to this. So Vanna and I have had, it's not really a fight, but we have, there's an ongoing thing. Vanna is the nicest person in the world, maybe, if you had a contest. And she works at it, and she takes pride. And I'm telling you, we had to go to some event last year. We're in a car. And we rarely are in a car together, but I was driving and I picked her up on the way, and I'm driving her back, and there's a tour bus next to us, you know, through Beverly Hills. And she said, "Oh, I'm going to say hello." And of course I said, don't say, you know, leave him alone. And she rolls on the window. "Hey," and everybody, and they all go get all excited. And then she points over to, we were in a convertible. Then she points over to me, and she says, "Look who's driving my car." So now I have to wave. So she's that kind of nice.
She's dragged you in. And say Jack is there, and he's behind the wheel, and he's like, he wants to put up two middle fingers and say, "Off all of you."
No, I don't want to say that. But what I did say to her, I said, you know, "Everybody has my license number now." So that's what I said to her. So I kid her about this, because she will. My attitude is, my job is to host. We're on a remote, or we're doing whatever we're doing. We're in the studio, and somebody says, "You need to do this." I just go ahead and do it, because it's easy. And they're the producer, or they're the director, whatever they are. She likes to question things, not to their faces, but to me. She'll say, "Well, why are we doing this?" I said, "I don't know it, because we want to do it." "Well, do you think we ought to be doing this?" I said, "Just do it." So she fetches more than I do. And nice. And people would be surprised.
Scandalous. That is scandalous. I appreciate you giving us that. Now it's going to be tension at the wheel, friction at the wheel. Yes, she's always complaining, despite the camouflage that she wears that makes her the nicest person in the universe.
You just summed it up. But however, I will say this, that I can't imagine working with anybody else. I mean, if you imagine, think about that. I mean, when the show was really, really hot in the 80s, she was on the cover of everything. And she would, and somehow it just never, she never played the diva. I mean, she doesn't try to put more importance of what she's doing. If you ask Anna, what do you do for a living? She says, hey, I touch letters and they light up. You know, mm-hmm. she's not saying, oh, I, you know, I'm going to direct one day. And she does, she takes, like me, she takes the job seriously, but she really doesn't take herself too seriously. It's a, you know, it, she knows it's a lightning in a bottle kind of thing. She knows that, you know, she knows what she does and she knows how to do it. And she takes pride in that. And her job in her, part of her job in her mind is to be this ambassador for the show and to be nice to people. I mean, that's not a bad thing.
Can you explain to me?
Can you hold, hang on, Dan. I think it was Leslie calling on the other phone. Hi.
Hi.
Say hi. You're talking to Dan Levitard. Say hi.
Hello, Leslie.
Oh, hi, Dan Levitard.
I was. I'm doing an interview with Dan. We're right in the middle of it.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. That's why you're on the other phone. Okay. Then call me back. I just don't know if you want to chili or fish.
Do I want chili or fish?
I think you want to go chili. You're feeling reckless today. You don't need the clean protein. You want to have the good stuff.
Yeah, I'm just thinking chilly.
Yeah, it feels like a chilly day, doesn't it?
It does. It's kind of gloomy and rainy here. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Sounds good.
All right. Bye. Thanks, sweetie. Bye. Well, there you go. A little. You're welcome to air that.
A little intimacy. We will air that. Let's just leave all of that in, and we will continue from right there. Were you done with your Vanna point? Or
I could see the last decades being nightmares working with some diva, and happily, it hasn't been that at all.
How about some places where Wheel of Fortune has ended up on a show, or you're asked to make a cameo, or something where you're actually proud of it, that it makes you happy because you're like, oh, that's cool that we would end up there as a cultural icon?
You know, honestly, the most thankless, for me personally, the most thankless thing in the world are these cameo roles. Again, when we first started, especially in the 80s, it was an interesting time. We were doing ratings in our nighttime show that are absolutely unheard of. You think I'm making them up. However, our daytime show, which aired on NBC, was still on the air at the same time. So I was doing both. And NBC in prime time was terrible. It was dying. It was just had the worst shows and the worst ratings. It was a very bleak period in the history of NBC. So they had this hot show in syndication. And they had some control over it because I was on NBC during the day. So they would get us to do these little cameo appearances on other shows. So what happens is, say you're doing, there was an old show called Give Me a Break, a sitcom that was on. So they'd write a script that somehow through some way involved Wheel of Fortune. You know, one of the girls from the show was on the show, whatever the script was. And then you have to tape part of this. You have to do part of this awful sitcom. And you don't get anything out of it because, first of all, your audience is bigger than theirs anyway. So you're not helping yourself. You're just playing yourself. So it's not like you're showing the world what a wonderful actor you are. So I hated doing them. And we did a bunch of them for all these dying NBC shows. So
name them.
One after another. And I would always say when they'd ask me.
Name them. Name the shows. What were the dying NBC shows? Do you remember?
Well, some of them had a nice run, but they were at the end of their runs. Give Me a Break was one of them. I'm at a loss now to think, but there must have been a half a dozen of them we did. They're so long ago.
The A-Team?
Well, the A-Team is part of the story. So one of them that was, I think, in its last season was the A-Team. Had a really good run. It was kind of a, you know, a sort of a...
I liked the A-Team when I was growing up. Mr. T, yeah. They made Mr. T a star, the A-Team did.
No, exactly. It had its audience. It was mostly for kids, and it did very well. Action, adventure, a little bit of comedy and all that. So it was fine. It wasn't my cup of tea, but it was fine. But in its last season, it was clearly its last season. So anyway, when they would come up with these cameos, the network would ask me. I would always say, no, I don't want to stay after work and do another thing and another. And then they would go up to the next level of management. And then the next. And then they would put pressure on you. Oh, you don't care about our network. This will save the network. This will save that show. You were always disloyal if you didn't do it. So I'd always cave in the end and do it and hate myself. And then say, why didn't I just agree in the first place? So anyway, the last one to come along is the A-Team. That's it. I don't want to do the A-Team. Same thing. I don't want to do it. Up the chain, up the ladder, up the thing. And they finally get to Brandon Tartikoff, a legendary figure in television. He was the head of NBC, saw them through.
Such a great television name. I thought Les Moonves was a good television name, but Brandon Tartikoff, that is a man who's running a television empire.
No, absolutely. And eventually he had great success with the network, but at this time they were in the toilet. So I'm not going to do it. Now it goes up to Tartikoff's office. Will you do it? So I was only on the air a few years. I don't know what possessed me. So I said, okay. I said to my agent, whoever I talked to, I said, look, I'll do it, but I want a letter. I had the nerve to say from Brandon Tartikoff, thanking me for all these cameos I've done and assuring me that this will be the last one he'll ever ask me to do. And I'll be damned. He wrote the letter and you know, he was cussing under his breath as he was signing. Who is this bastard? And I was cleaning out files of just a few weeks ago and I found it. It exists. He actually wrote the darn thing. It was very nice, but he could not have enjoyed doing it.
But what was going on with you? You're not an actual diva who throws his power around. Like, I can't believe that this is a story that you're telling from a couple of years into your career. Like, what are you thinking?
I don't know. I used to, it's funny. I never, I get along with most people. For some reason, with some notable exceptions, I never got along much with television management types. I don't know. I don't understand them. I don't know who aspires to those positions. I don't exactly know what it is they do. And they come in and out. So they come in.
I feel you, Pat.
You know how it is, Danny. They come in, they ruin your life, or they try to, and then they go to another network.
Yes,
and
that is correct.
Then you're stuck with whatever they did to you.
No, but I love that analysis. Who aspires to that?
And then a new guy comes in, and he does the same thing in a different direction, and you got to put up with this thing. And in 3 years, he's got a better job. So it doesn't pay. Now, again, I say notable exceptions. We've had a couple of great guys during our run at Wheel who have been the smart ones who have said, you know, go do your show because it's been on 20 years. What do I know? But they're all brilliant and they all do that. Even in local television, I was a bit of a troublemaker, not on camera, but with these guys. I mean, if they said do A, I always wanted to do B because I just didn't like him very much. My attorney once said when the talk show was clearly in trouble, he said, you know, if you would schmooze with these guys, talking about the management a little more, you'd probably get an extra couple of years out of there. I said, I hate these guys. I'm not schmoozing. So I don't know what it is, but they rubbed me the wrong way. They really.
But never on a show that you admire, though, like never a movie or a show that you admire. Like, I don't know if it's something that you watch or watching with your daughter or maybe your family's like, hey, that's cool. You're on The Simpsons or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever it might be.
Sure. Do you know when I was doing the talk show, we got a call and they were, you remember there was a movie Mike Nichols directed called Postcards from the Edge. It was about Carrie Fisher and based on a book she'd written. And Meryl Streep was the star. And there was a scene where she was going to appear on the talk show and they wanted to film it with us. Well, I'm not going to interview Meryl Streep in a fake interview for a movie. Of course I am. And we did it and Mike Nichols was great and thankful and brought in pies for everybody. And Meryl could not have been nicer and more professional and was so, you know, you think these actresses are, you wonder what makes them tick. She came on and did the fake interview with me and she was so believable in her role and had the audience who had no idea the context of this thing laughing and applauding. She was absolutely brilliant. So I was excited about that, except that shortly after that, the show was canceled. So they dumped that scene. So they didn't want her on a failed talk show. But yeah, every now and then there's one. I mean, most of these shows, first of all, it's such a stretch. Think about any show that's on the air. How do you work Wheel of Fortune in? I would have been happy to be on Cheers or shows that I admired. But for most of them, we were there in their dying days. And I wasn't real thrilled about it.
Does your family have a love of the Wheel? Does your family ever stop and watch you on television? Does your family at this point care at all that you're this person who goes to work and they could just flip on their television and watch what dad or their husband did at work? Or are they no longer interested in any way? How many years has it been since anyone in the family sat in front of a television and watched you work?
You know, it hasn't been that long. I can't say that they're regular viewers, but especially if we're apart a lot, because I'll go out the West Coast to tape, and we live mostly in the East, and sometimes they won't make the trip, so they'll be here, and they frequently will watch, and I'll hear. Like, you know, they don't hang on my every word, but they'll say, "Hey, you made me laugh yesterday when you said so and so," and that was kind of nice, but. And I have to say, early on, I would watch occasionally because I wanted to be sure I wasn't, you know, I hadn't developed some annoying tick that I hadn't noticed until I watched it. But after the years, even if I have an annoying tick, I'm not going to change. So they're stuck with what I am. So I rarely watch, to be honest with you. But I was in a room and the TV was on, and we went to the bonus round, and there was some little special effect that they put in the post-production. That was really cool. So next time we tape, I said to our executive producer, I said, "I love that thing you're doing with that effect." And he said, "We've been doing that for 12 years, Pat." So
12 years?
12 years, 12? Yeah. So maybe I missed that.
I don't know if you have any good Pentagon stories, do you? Do you have like a... Your time working in the Pentagon.
I was in Vietnam for a year and a half. And when I came back, I had another year left in the Army. I was in for 3 years. I joined. And I was assigned to the Pentagon. And I was an audio visual guy. I was a disc jockey in Vietnam, but they made me some audio visual guy. And here was my job. Down in the sub basement of the Pentagon is a room, I guess, where all the generals will go if there's an atomic war. And there, it looks like Dr. Strangelove, and there are these big screens, and my job was to run, if they would go in and do a briefing to people, and my job was to run the audio visual materials for the briefing, with, you know, slides back then, slides and movies and things like that, and so it never, happily, never got used. It was never a war. The only time it ever got used, there was a postal strike, and the Army helped deliver the mail back. So while we were back there for briefings on the mail, that was about it. The only thing I remember about the Pentagon is it's impossible to describe how big it is. I mean, it's just miles and miles and miles of corridors, and the parking lot is enormous. So I'm an enlisted guy, and, you know, I park in the far end of the parking lot, and then you got to walk to the building. Well, on the way in, you pass about 4,000 officers. So you're saluting. All I remember is my arm hurt from working at the Pentagon, because all I did was salute. And these guys didn't want to be saluted. They would kind of, you know, wave their pinky at me, and that was about it. But if I didn't salute, I got in trouble. So all I did was salute for a year at the Pentagon. I don't know if I hope they still don't have to do that in the parking lot. It doesn't make any sense.
What is the story behind you ending up in the military? Is there a backstory there that is interesting?
Not really. I mean, it's kind of odd when I think back. I was in college in Chicago, and I went to a school called Columbia College, which is a pretty good school now. At the time, I'm not even sure it was accredited, frankly. And the only reason I went there is because they had a really good broadcasting department taught by local broadcasting people in Chicago whom I knew from, you know, growing up there. So that I liked that. So the actual classes, non-broadcasting classes, I'm not sure how good they were, and I didn't do that well, but I did fine. But I got into I finished my third year, and I start my fourth year, and I felt I learned all I could learn about broadcasting. And I frankly, getting a degree didn't interest me all that much. And I said, "What am I going to do next?" And I said, "You know, I think I'm going to join the Army." It was kind of as simple as that. And I came home and I mentioned to my parents, "You know, how was your day?" "It's fine." And I just came back from the recruiting station. I'm leaving next week. So,
oh wow,
it's not a great story. And it was almost that quick and impulsive. There may have been going through my head at the time, but I don't remember it if there was.
Was there a chance of you fighting?
Oh yeah. I mean, you join the Army and you don't know where you're. Yeah, of course. So you join the Army, and I was hopeful that my broadcasting credentials, because even though I had worked at a little radio station in Chicago, and, you know, I went to school and so I thought I might be able to wheedle my way into that side of things. Instead, we go through basic training, and they made me in basic training. They trained me as a clerk typist. I had never touched a typewriter in my life. I don't know why. They just assign you these things. You wonder why we have trouble sometimes. So I'm trained as a clerk typist. I go through basic training and then another 8 weeks where they teach you your specialty, in this case, clerk typing. And then they get the whole group that graduated, and they get you, I'll never forget this, they get you in a big sort of field, and you know they're about to announce where you're going to go for your service. And they called about 25 names out of the several hundred of us that were gathered and said, you're all going to Germany. The rest of you are going to Vietnam. So there you go. So now we go to Vietnam, and I was going to be a clerk typist rather than an infantryman. I knew that. So that was good. And I got assigned to a place called Long Binh, which is a fort about 30 miles outside of Saigon. And they made me, I'm trained as a clerk typist. They make me a finance clerk where I have to deal with people's pay records.
They didn't want you anywhere near the fighting.
Apparently not.
They saw your manicured fingers and they saw your waifish physique. And they're like, we can't send this out there defending America. Our freedoms can't be in peril. Make him a typist. Make him do math.
But we were close enough. I mean, this sounds just so surreal now, but there were at night sometimes we would climb on top of these little tin Quonset huts and sit there on a lounge chair with a beer and watch helicopter firefights. I mean, as bizarre as that sounds. Then I had an opportunity through someone I met to move to Saigon to go into Armed Forces Radio. But I was doing everything I do well because I take it seriously. I became a really good finance clerk. Guys would come in from the field and in tears thanking me for finally getting their pay unscrewed and their family getting paid. Anyway, they valued me too much. And so every time I would put in a request for the transfer, they wouldn't let me do it. And I finally enlisted the aid of an Illinois congressman who wrote a letter on my behalf, and I didn't realize then what pull they have. And suddenly my transfer was approved, and I went to Saigon and did the morning radio show there. So I never came close to combat. I never was on the verge of it. When I went to Vietnam, they could have done anything they wanted with me. Happily, they gave me finance records instead of an M16.
I love that in the middle of that, all I heard was everything I do well. Like, I love that people are seeing the chest thumping,
I agree. But I'll tell you what, if there's anything I value, I can't tell you how many times I have written a letter or picked up the phone and called a company on behalf of someone who just was doing a semi-menial job, but taking it seriously and doing it well. I mean, you know, if you're going to do something, you owe it to yourself and nobody else to take it seriously and do it right. And I admire that in everyone. And I take pride in that. And yeah, I say that with no apologies. Even if I don't do well, I try to do well.
Where does that come from?
I don't know. My father, I call my father, he's really my stepfather, but he and my mother were married for 35 years. He worked in Chicago. He worked on a truck dock. A truck would come pull up, these massive trucks, and he would transfer loads from one truck to another that truck would go on. He was a member of the Teamsters, and he worked his back off. I mean, out in Chicago, outdoors, winter, summer. I did it one summer. I worked there and it was the hardest summer of my life. It was very hard work, but he showed up every day. He was sick. It didn't matter. He did his job. He came home. He didn't complain a whole lot about it. But the irony is, I remember him coming home one time and he had a 35-year pin from Hennis Freight Lines. He was very proud of his little pin. And I who can blame him? And I wasn't the most grateful kid in the world, what kids are. And I looked at the pin and I said, oh, that's great, Dad. And my stupid brain said, can you imagine doing the same thing for 35 years? Well, I'm going on 40. Now, admittedly, they send limos for me and they didn't for him. But it is funny. Be careful what you wish for.
Is there something in particular that might surprise us that you have excelled at because you applied yourself to it, learned it, decided to do it well, and then we learn Pat Sajak has this secret skill. He's got a black belt in jiu-jitsu and he would kick the ass of any man in any fight.
No, I would be killed immediately, and by most even reasonably strong women. I don't think I'm an effete snob. I'm handier around the house than people think, and I'm my tastes are pretty simple. I mentioned leaving college in the fourth year and not really applying myself well. I do take pride in the fact that I've worked hard at bettering myself intellectually that way. I mean, I read a lot, and I've taken courses at colleges I once had it in my mind to finish college not that long ago, 15, 20 years ago. And I did, and I was so lacking because the school I went to, as I say, may not even have been accredited. So a lot of the stuff didn't even, so I had a lot of classes to make up. So all of the literature, the history, that kind of thing, philosophy, those were great. But then they started piling like chemistry on me. And I remember looking at a chemistry book saying, I really don't want a degree that badly. So I stopped at that. So I've worked hard at being able to hold a reasonably intelligent conversation, but I have no special skills at all.
Well, what did you learn as a dad? Because you've got some well-adjusted kids, and that's a broad question. What did you learn as a dad? But I guess what I would ask you is, what makes a good parent? Like, what have you learned through marriage and parenting that you would say that you would impart as advice on how to raise a child?
Well, you know, these days you have to be careful what you say in that regard, because you're shaming someone, and that's not what this is about. However, I'm telling you, half of it is just showing up. It's being there. You know, it's easy to say, well, we're not, you know, I'm gone a lot, I'm not there, but we have quality time. Well, they like quantity too. And I know some circumstances don't make that possible. And also our kids were, you know, raised in a two-parent family. And I know, and that's a controversial thing to say. And I know that that's not possible for everyone. And you know, bravo to those who make that work. But you're asking what factors sort of worked for us. And I think that was an important one. They had a mother figure and they had a father figure. And it doesn't mean, that's not to say it can't be done without. And in some cases, it absolutely has to be done without. But we were lucky that it didn't, I think. And they were, and I think that was a big part of it. And you know, you listen and there is, you know, there is something to leading by example. You can't go wild and, you know, and expect your kids not to go wild. When I'm in a grocery store to this day and I see kids running crazy, I want to smack the parent. You know, you can actually make them stop that. And we did that. I don't say tough disciplinarians, but we didn't put up with that kind of nonsense. If you went to a restaurant, our friends we'd go to a restaurant with our kids when they were little, they go, they're just sitting there. I said, well, in a restaurant, that's what they're supposed to do. So they weren't little marionettes, but they were behaved when they should be. They respected their elders, which they should. My wife to this day calls friends that her parents knew when she was a kid, and she's in her 50s now, calls them Mr. and Mrs. I mean, that's just what she does. So I think, you know, so they see how you act, and they, although I met one time we're at a Benihana. We're in New York. And I said to the kids, where do you want to go? Anywhere you want to go. We're in New York, you know, Big Apple, all these restaurants when they used
Benihana.
And they wanted to go to Benihana. Okay, fine. There's a Benihana near. So we go to Benihana and we're at a table and we're eating. And I look over at the next table and there's an Asian family, a man and a woman, nicely dressed with two daughters about our kids' age. Gorgeous in their little dresses, and they're reading books at the table. And then I glanced over at my kids, and they were having a contest to see who could make their lips go flatter by pushing chopsticks against them. And I thought, there's the difference in cultures right there.
What is it that you look around America these days and has you, you know, you're a person who absorbs, and you're a person who has learned through living. So you look at America these days, and what are the things that most alarm you?
It's Americans demonizing other Americans. You know, I've always been interested in politics, and politics has always been rough. And you can be really rough on the man or woman on the other side of the aisle, and you can call him this, and you can call this guy a thief, and you can call. But when you start demeaning the voter himself, because you disagree with something. And so anyone who does this is not worthy of your friendship. He's not worthy talking about. I mean, families are breaking up. That's the difference. Now we used to be really tough on politicians. We are now tough on the people who vote for them. And I don't know how we heal that. And it's not as if there's some fringe group here. This is half the country doing this to the other half, and vice versa. There's blame on all sides. But we got to somehow, I don't care how caustic you might think the politician is. I'm not talking about anyone in particular. But the idea that the rest of the country is not worth your attention, and you start name calling, and then you wonder why you guys can't get together, and then you want civility, and then, you know, I don't know how we get past this. Again, it's not a small group on one side that's going, you know, we're in a 50-50 country right now. And even that would be okay if we could, you don't have to agree with the other side. You don't have to respect their views, but my God, you can't cut them off from day-to-day contact because of this. So I think the well is so poisoned. I don't know how it could ever straighten out. I really don't. And I find it really depressing. It's a gloomy day and I'm feeling gloomy about it. That troubles me a lot.
That is a depressing end to this conversation. That is not how I wanted this to end. So,
yeah, but you know what? I'll say this. My first 20 years of the new millennium has been challenging in a lot of ways and a lot of things happening and all that. But think about the last century and what the country accomplished despite not one but two world wars and a Great Depression and Vietnam and assassinations and civil unrest that makes what's going on today like recess at a grammar school. And somehow we got through it. So the optimistic side of me says we will do that again, but when you're in the middle of it, it seems tough.
I love you, buddy. Thank you for always making time for us.
Yeah, anytime. You're the best, and good luck.
All right, that's got to do it for us here on South Beach Sessions for this week. Hey, I know Pat Sajak is very popular, and many of you are coming to this South Beach session sort of like a menu item because you expect it to be good whenever Pat joins Dan, and you're probably right. But while I have you, why don't you check out some of our previous episodes? If you haven't, you've missed some pretty good ones, especially last week's with Method Man. Make sure to do that. Drop us a rating and a review because, trust me when I say, this is our currency. If you're listening to this right now, 5-star review, subscribe to this feed and the Levitard and Friends feed. It all helps us in the end. We try to help you by putting out good content, bring you some sunshine, some rays of sunshine into your life. Please help us out by rewarding us with one of those subscriptions. We're on a bye week next week because of the holiday. Please be safe out there. Follow guidelines, and we'll be back with you with another episode. A lot of exciting guests on the horizon here on South Beach Sessions. So make sure to subscribe so you're the first ones to get all those episodes. Thank you. We'll talk to you soon.